From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We threw off the structure of monarchy in 1776, but not quite its trappings. That's why, though there is no crown, in America every 4 years there is still an interregnum. And Barton Gellman, in the U.S. context, what do you call the interregnum?
Hi. The interregnum is the transition time between election day and the swearing in of the new president 79 days later. And there are a number of intermediate steps that normally don't count for much. They're mostly pro forma, but this year may not be.
May not be. I mean, and most of the time, people don't even think about that interregnum phase. But you have written extensively about it in The Atlantic. That's where Bart Gellman is a staff writer, and he published a piece for the November issue. It came out, actually, it was posted a couple of weeks ago. The piece is titled "The Election That Could Break America." So what are the dates between November 3rd and January 20th that people ought to be paying close attention to, Bart?
So we're accustomed to getting a count, a result on election night, or maybe in the early hours of the next day. That is not the formal count. So each precinct will report up through counties. There are something like 10,500 local jurisdictions that actually administer elections. They're not a federal job. And then these feed into a certified count by the state sooner or later, well after Election Day. Then on December 8th is an obscure deadline known as the Safe Harbor Date, by which each state must choose a final slate of electors, the actual human beings who cast the electoral votes, which actually elect a president. And December 14th, the Electoral College meets in its separate delegations in the 50 states. And then on January 6th, not until January 6th, is the president selected. The actual formal count of electoral votes is done in Congress in a joint session presided over by the Vice President of the United States. And any of these milestones could be occasions of conflict this year.
Now, we've done several shows about what could possibly happen between November 3rd and December 8th, in terms of the actual vote count, the votes that individual Americans cast. We'll come back to that a little later in the show, Bart, but I want to get right to December 8th, which in your piece you call the date that could present the first genuine constitutional crisis in this election. So if you just stick with me for a second, Bart, we actually talked to Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. And just as Bart said, December 8th is that date where the 538 electors are the 14th is when they convene, and the 8th is when they first are chosen, the electors are chosen, Bart?
That's correct.
Okay, good. Just want to get all these dates right. Okay, so here's what Lawrence Lessig said about the significance of the electors this year.
We have not since 1876, except once, seen a case where a state has sent more than one slate of electors to Congress to count. There were three states that sent two slates of electors, each side claiming the other side had engaged in fraud, which justified them to send the slates. And that led to the passage of the Electoral Count Act.
The Electoral Count Act of 1887, referred to by one group of legal scholars in 2020, by the way, as, quote, a morass of ambiguity, which is the exact opposite of what's required for this election. Now, the Electoral Count Act was passed in the aftermath of the race between Rutherford Hayes and Samuel Tilden, which, by the way, helped determine the shape of Reconstruction in the South. And the act requires electors to be chosen, as Bart Gellman has been telling us, for the Electoral College no more than 41 days after Election Day. But meeting that deadline this year could get very complicated in a pandemic with historic numbers of mail-in ballots and a candidate who has long been crying fraud.
It's not hard to imagine a state legislature standing up and saying, we think this was a fraudulent election, therefore we're going to exercise the power the Supreme Court seems to have given us and say that we have the right to pick a new slate of electors. So we're going to pick a new slate of electors. and send them to Congress and have Congress figure out how they're going to count them. That's completely feasible, right? That you don't have to construct facts in the world to do that. You just have to get people willing to take the political heat for acting in a way that seems contrary to the vote of the people in their state.
Now, Lawrence Lessig told us one more thing. He says the Electoral Count Act relies on Congress and its behaviors, its interests and norms and practices, which until 2020, no one really ever thought about.
If you presume that Congress is going to act as a faithful court, then the system works fine. But when you recognize that in these irrationally partisan times, Congress, these legal standards evaporate and Congress just behaves in a completely partisan way, the structure that the Electoral Count Act has set up is a potential disaster. Because what it says is, if there's a conflict about any of these slates, and there's multiple slates, but one happens to be signed by the governor, then that's the slate that prevails.
So that's Lawrence Lessig from Harvard Law School. Bart Gellman, is it possible that we may have a situation come December 8th and December 14th where the electors who are going to formally make up the Electoral College are not actually representing the popular vote in their states?
Well, we could. We don't have to imagine it. In my story in The Atlantic, I describe conversations with national and state representatives of the Trump campaign who are themselves imagining it, who are making contingency plans in which they would consider going to the legislatures, Republican legislatures in important swing states where the elections are close, and saying, you ought to exercise your power to appoint electors. And let's just clarify this. It says in the Constitution, Article 2, that electors shall be chosen in the several states by such means as the legislature shall decide. And it used to be the case that legislatures routinely appointed the electors. There was no popular vote that meant anything. We've been accustomed for more than a century now to voting for our president, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to do it that way. Now, it may feel a bit like a coup to set aside the popular vote, but the Republican legislators who might do this, if they did it, would not say they were disregarding the popular vote. They would say that the popular vote had been poisoned by fraud and vote rigging and couldn't be determined.
So can we talk about, more specifically about what members of the GOP have told you? Let's focus on Pennsylvania for a second, because the Pennsylvania Republican Party chair, you quoted him as saying, I've mentioned it to them, meaning, I guess, to Trump's national campaign. I hope they're thinking about it, too. About strategies and approaches to directly elect a slate of electors in Pennsylvania.
He did. He said exactly that. And he did not want to talk about what his strategies and plans would be. But he said that this was an available option under the Constitution. The Republicans understood this and understood their responsibilities in this connection. And that what his preference was that there would be a rapid and accurate count on election night, and everyone would understand who had won the vote. But if the vote dragged on and people lost confidence in it, then there might be other measures that would be required. And the thing about that is it's not a very forthcoming statement from this chairman, Larry Tabus. He's the party chairman of the state. Because he well knows there can't possibly be an election night result in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is going to have an estimated 2 or 3 million mail-in ballots. And under Pennsylvania law, they can't even be opened to begin the review and counting process until polls close on election night. There is no chance of a result from Pennsylvania on election night, and likely not the next day either.
Well, and now we have a Supreme Court decision, a 4-4 split this week, that will allow ballots to be counted in Pennsylvania for up to three days after the election, right? There was an attempt to stop that, but the court, 4-4 split, has said no. The or that they're affirming a lower court order that says no, the ballots will be counted after the election, right?
Right. So by failing to decide, by having a 4-4 tie, the court has left standing the lower court result. And so ballots that are postmarked by election day but arrive up to 3 days afterward will count. Mm.
But let me ask you.
So, I mean, so they literally can't finish counting until 3 days afterward.
Yeah. So you said, though, that there's this time period that allows for the loss of confidence in the count itself, and that as you said, the Pennsylvania state GOP prefers to have a result on the night of November 3rd. I mean, loss of confidence or the sowing of a lack of confidence, right? The deliberate undermining of confidence.
Right. The loss of confidence is not something that happens by itself. There's only one person and one party that is promoting a loss of confidence in this race right now. It's the president and his party, who is already announcing that the vote will be rigged, that fraud is going to happen, and intends to send the message loud and clear up until election day and afterward that you can't trust the vote. The vote count is untrustworthy. And the basic fundamental mechanism of how we choose a president is flawed. And that's an astonishing message to hear from the president. And it is completely undermining of the whole idea of election.
Yeah. Well, so just to clarify one thing that I said, the Supreme Court's ruling is that the state of Pennsylvania has to accept ballots that they receive up to 3 days after election. So the count's probably going to be even longer than that. And Bart, we're going to take a quick break here. I'll let you get to that phone. We'll come back in a minute because we are talking about protecting the vote after the vote. There's a lot more to discuss. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about protecting the vote after the vote, after November 3rd, essentially this key period of time after November 3rd to January 20th, when a lot of important election-related decisions are made. Most of the time, we don't even think about them. But this year, there's every reason to consider them. And we're joined today by Barton Gilman. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's written an extensive piece on this period that he calls the interregnum. It's titled The Election That Could Break America. And Bart, we were talking about December 8th and the selection of electors, those 538 electors for the United States, and whether certain states would circumvent the popular vote essentially, and legislators there would select their own slate of electors. Now, the Trump campaign did respond to you in your reporting of this story, and they essentially said it was unfair that that the president was being vilified for doing what was necessary to guarantee a free and fair election. I'm just wondering if you would respond a little bit to how the Trump campaign itself sees this question of electors.
Well, I was surprised, frankly, that when I had sources telling me that the Trump campaign was considering a strategy in which they would ask state legislators to bypass the popular vote, I was surprised that the Trump campaign did not deny that. And they did not deny it. They simply attacked the whole piece and said that this was another case of fake media vilifying Trump, as you say, for looking for a free and fair election. They did not respond to any specific questions, in which I gave them an opportunity to say, no, of course, we would not try to set aside the popular vote.
So, but the possibility here is that you spoke to a legal advisor for the Trump campaign, and that person told you that the push to appoint electors would be framed in terms of protecting the people's will. But this is the thing I want to hear a little bit more about, Bart. The campaign itself wouldn't actually be doing anything in this case. It would be officials at the state level, no?
Yes, this is the elections are administered at the state and local level, and the count happens at the state and local level, and the appointment of electors happens at the state level. So, I mean, to make this a little bit more concrete, maybe it's easier to picture it in a particular case. Let's suppose in Pennsylvania, the official count has Biden ahead. Trump is, let's say it's as it is today, without any evidence at all, simply claiming, making up out of whole cloth the idea that the vote is rigged against him, that there's massive fraud happening under some theory or another. And the state legislature, taking its cue from Trump, says, we can't trust the count, and we're therefore going to appoint electors for Trump. So electors are human beings who are pledged to one candidate or another. So there is a slate of electors to represent Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes that are standing by pledged to Trump. And there's another one that is standing by pledged to Biden. The Republican legislature appoints the Trump electors, regardless of the vote. The governor, who's a Democrat, certifies the official count and therefore sends a slate of electors in what's called a certificate of ascertainment, sends that forward to the Electoral College for Biden. So now there are two groups of 20 people, each claiming to represent the electoral votes of Pennsylvania. And on December 14th, they will each meet and purport to cast Pennsylvania's votes in opposite directions. That's where the crisis begins.
So this isn't theoretical, to your point, because in 2000, exactly this almost happened, right? I mean, I had actually forgotten about this part of the Bush v. Gore election debacle. Can you remind us what happened in terms of which electors were certified in the state of Florida?
Right. And this was the interesting thing about what Larry Lessig said, because it's true that as far as I know, we haven't had a case since 1876 in which a state legislature actually appointed electors to compete with the ones that were based on the certified vote. It came very, very close to happening in Florida in 2000. The Supreme Court made its decision stopping the recount in Florida on December 12th. December 13th, the state assembly, which was controlled by Republicans, voted, even though the litigation was ongoing, that it was going to send a slate of electors for George W. Bush to be counted in the Electoral College. The state Senate was scheduled to vote on the same day. It happened that Al Gore came out on the 13th and conceded defeat. He conceded that the Supreme Court decision would be the final outcome of the case, which he did not actually have to do, and that George Bush was the new president and would be his president as well. And therefore, the state Senate did not cast a vote to appoint electors. But if Gore had not conceded, or if the case was ongoing at that point, you would have had the Florida legislature appointing Republican electors, even though the case was still underway. And Gore's staff had plans to convene the Democratic electors for Gore and have them cast sort of put forward their certificate as well.
Yeah.
And so there would have been dueling slates that year.
This paragraph of your, like every paragraph of your story was so eye-opening, but this one really caught my attention because just to underscore what you're saying, Bart, in 2000, we had then Governor Jeb Bush of Florida late in November, even as the litigation over the recount was going on, he went ahead and certified electors for his brother, George W. And as you were saying, people on the Gore side, Ronald Klain in particular, as you reported, just the details are just booked a room in old Florida Capitol building to do what you said, to convene Democratic electors to cast rival ballots for Gore. Now, as you mentioned, on December 13th, all of that was rendered unnecessary because Al Gore came out and said this.
Some have expressed concern that the unusual nature of this election might hamper the next president in the conduct of his office. I do not believe it need be so. President-elect Bush inherits a nation whose citizens will be ready to assist him in the conduct of his large responsibilities. I personally will be at his disposal, and I call on all Americans. I particularly urge all who stood with us to unite behind our next president.
So part of the actual concession speech that Al Gore gave on December 13th, 2000. Now, Bart, in your story, the point you're trying to drive home to Americans is that it's Gore's decision that stopped a potential constitutional crisis. So we don't know what would have happened had he not conceded. And that is the scenario that you and other constitutional scholars are concerned that we may be facing this time around.
Right, Megan. And I want to emphasize, I'm not saying I know this is going to happen. I'm not saying it's a sure thing.
Right.
It could still be regarded as unlikely just because it is so very rare in American politics, and it requires that elected officials in a state government declare that their own vote count is fraudulent and can't be relied upon, and that they're going to bypass the popular will. And that is a very big step. It's just not an unimaginable step in these days of hyper-partisanship, and it's one that the Trump campaign itself has imagined.
Well, and they've imagined in part because their own candidate. You start your story by saying you don't see any situation, any conceivable scenario, in which, short of an out and out landslide victory for President Trump and a Biden concession, you don't conceive of any scenario where President Trump concedes.
Right. He won't concede. He simply won't under any circumstances. And that is a very big fact to grapple with because it has cascading effects throughout the whole system. Concessions, it's counterintuitive because it puts so much power in the hands of the loser. But the concessions is the way that we end elections. We don't have a grand umpire in our system who blows the whistle at the end of the game and says, you won, you lost, get over it. And if it's a baseball game, the losing coach can shout and scream that the other side cheated, that the reffing was terrible, that they really won, but it's of no consequence except bad sportsmanship. In this system, especially when it's the incumbent president who has all the powers of his office behind him, who refuses to accept the legitimacy of the loss, he is capable of preventing the emergence of a decisive result itself. It's not that he loses and won't leave. It's that he can prevent himself from decisively losing because he can tie up the machinery that decides the winner loss.
So Bart, stand by for a second because I want to now bring in Jason Harrow. Joins us from Los Angeles. He's executive director and chief counsel at Equal Citizens, a nonprofit focused on repairing democracy by establishing truly equal citizenship. And he was also co-counsel in a Supreme Court case decided in May 2020, Colorado v. Baca. And that had to do with so-called faithless electors. Jason Harrow, welcome to the show.
Hi, Meghna. It's great to be here.
Okay. And now you are here to tell us, don't hyperventilate. No need to generate useless panic. It's all going to be okay. All of these scenarios that we're imagining are just intellectual exercises, not grounded in a foreseeable reality, in your view, Jason?
I think that's a good way of putting it, Meghna. I mean, in the course of our Supreme Court case, which was the most recent proclamation from the Supreme Court about the role of electors and what happens in this period that you and Bart have been talking about, I sort of dug deeply into the mechanisms and opened up the hood, as Bart has done in his wonderful article, to see what's going on in this interregnum period. And I agree with Bart that it's possible for a lot of wild and unprecedented and outrageous scenarios. And his reporting is remarkable that the folks affiliated with Trump and the campaign are thinking about some extreme steps, although I'll note that that's not particularly uncommon. We know from some recent reporting that the George W. Bush team had tried for a play in the 2000 election when there was an indication that he might win the popular vote while losing the electoral vote. So the reverse of what happened, that he was going to engage in a campaign to persuade presidential electors who were supposed to vote for Al Gore. This is one aspect that, of the system that you haven't even covered yet. That not in all states they necessarily have to vote for this particular candidate, that they were going to launch a campaign to say, hey, you know, yeah, you're supposed to vote for Al Gore, but George W. Bush won the popular vote, so why don't you break from your expectations? So that this has been tried, outrageous schemes have been thought about, but I just want to point out that it's really hard, right? There are rules. The last thing that Bart said was, there's no umpire. It's really about the concession speech. I sort of respectfully disagree there, because there are state canvassing boards, there's state Supreme Courts, there's state election officials. They do the counts. They are required to count in a particular way and certify results in a particular way. It's malleable. It's uncertain, Meghna, but I do think we do have rules, and it's not all about whether the current president wants to accept them or wants to make up an alternative reality.
Okay, so about those rules, here's what Larry Lessig at Harvard, here's what he told us.
My lawyer friends are like, well, if they apply the law, this will be an easy problem to solve, to which the response is, right, but we don't live in that world. We live in a world of no good faith. And so the law is not the constraint. The constraint is, what can I argue colorable? What are the colorable arguments I can make to get to my side? And plainly, there are plenty.
Jason, you are one of Larry Lessig's lawyer friends. That's you he's talking about.
Yes, indeed. He and I each argued cases about the electors, and we work closely together at our nonprofit. But you know, I think that it's important to understand that there's so many different actors and so many possible areas of law here, and where good faith can break down is not everywhere, right? So I'm looking, as we speak, Meghna, at the details of the Pennsylvania statutes, 25 Pennsylvania statutes, 3146.8, right? You know, you got to dig deeply into these things. And there are there's a provision, and you know, you've talked a lot about absentee ballots in Pennsylvania, and the law says that an absentee ballot cast by an absentee elector shall be canvassed, which is counted, right? And it goes on, an absentee ballot cast by an elector shall be canvassed at the appropriate time and reported, da 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 da. Well, this is not a big constitutional issue, which I agree can be very uncertain and subject to the whims of what is now a Supreme Court that is sort of rapidly moving right. And indeed, Judge Barrett may be confirmed in part to move it even further right for the election. But that provision, Meghna, and provisions in every other state saying, here's a vote, county board, you've received it, you must count it. That's not something that is really subject to interpretation or good faith or bad faith. Though there have been, to my knowledge, no elections in U.S. history, and there are thousands every year, where provisions like that have simply been ignored, where election officials have ignored wide swaths of ballots essentially just because one party says that there's allegations of fraud, right? They would need to be counted and then challenged and then looked at, and then a court would need to say, no, you count this group and not this group. These have the proper signatures. These were too late, et cetera, in an orderly way, not on the whims of a candidate.
But this year around, though, and is given the historic numbers of mail-in ballots, for example, given the pandemic, can that orderly count be achieved in the time period allotted with things like the Electoral Count Act and things like that?
It's a great question. The pandemic certainly changes things, but absentee and mail-in ballots are not new, Meghna. They've been increasing at a rapid rate even before the pandemic. In the 2018 election, 9 states had more than 50% of their ballots cast by mail.
But if let me, just let me jump in here, because I have to ask. Yes, but if the campaigns on both sides are going to file motion after motion after motion to contest the counts or to get things recounted, can we get a final number in time?
I hear the music is going to come out. So the short answer is there's no guarantee, but I really think so, Meghna, and I hope so.
Okay,
and we can talk more about
that. I will give you a chance to give us a more thorough answer after the music and Bart Gellman too. We're talking about protecting the vote after the vote, meaning what happens after November 3rd. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, since it'll be Wednesday, we're going to be having our weekly voter roundtable. And we are going to be speaking with people who have deeply suffered due to COVID-19, whether they themselves were hospitalized or lost a loved one, and how the pandemic and the impact it's had on them has changed or helped shape their view of this election. So if you've lost a loved one, if you yourself fell gravely ill due to COVID, give us a call and tell us your story and tell us how it has had an impact on how you view this election. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today we are talking about protecting the vote after the vote. That's how I'm phrasing it. It's that period after November 3rd through January 20th, when normally the machinery of our electoral democracy works and a president is inaugurated. But this year there's any number of reasons to take a closer look at how that machinery is supposed to work. And Barton Gellman joins us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He has written an extensive piece calling to attention the things that could lead to potential constitutional crises in this period. The piece is called The Election That Could Break America. And Jason Harrow also joins us. He's executive director and chief counsel at Equal Citizens, a nonprofit focused on establishing truly equal citizenship. Now, Jason, you were going to give me a longer answer before the break about why you have confidence that many of these potential nightmare scenarios may not come to pass, that ballots will be counted, electors will be certified, they will put forth their vote in the Electoral College on December 14th. So what's giving you that confidence?
Yeah, you know, in addition to what we talked about before, I am also pretty confident that most elections, Meghna, just are not that close. And what that means is that there's much less wiggle room here and room to maneuver for the various campaigns, whether it's Trump or Biden trying to challenge results. There's been some remarkable reports put out. There's a group called Fair Vote that does terrific work and research on this. They looked at recounts in statewide elections since 2000. About 1 in 200 elections statewide go to recounts. And when they do go to recounts, the average number of votes changed is 282 votes. Mm. So these have to be extremely close elections. We're talking Florida in 2000, which, Meghna, since you went back to the history, the vault of the 2000 election, you may remember the final tally was 537 votes separated Bush and Gore in Florida in 2000. And that state was determinative of the outcome. If something like that happens, we're in for the nightmare scenario. Agree with you, agree with Bart. That's going to be really bad and potentially even more destructive and polarizing than 2000.
So Bart, you want to jump in here? Let me just, Jason, I'll come back to you in a second. But Bart, you've been patiently listening. You want to jump in here and respond?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a big disagreement. I think that there's a difference of emphasis. And let's put it this way. If you're a smart lawyer, as many smart lawyers have argued in this case, you say, well, Trump could claim this or claim that, or legislators could purport to take back authority, but they'd be laughed out of court, that there would be no merit to their legal argument. And my point is that in a hyperpartisan environment, it's not necessarily a courtroom that's going to decide this. What the legislatures would need is only, frankly, a pretextual argument. All they need to do is switch forums. Because if they send, there's no court that can stop them from sending a second slate of electors to Congress. And Congress has the authority to decide which electors count when it comes to January 6th. Congress gave itself that authority in the Electoral Count Act. And under certain circumstances, Congress can be tied up in knots, which leads to further opportunities for chaos as the count goes forward. And there's one more point, which is this. Bringing to light now the possibility of a legislature overturning the popular will and forcing state legislators to answer the question, would you do that, has a deterrent effect. It could be that by focusing attention on this right now, we are making it less likely that someone will try this maneuver.
Right. I mean, to your point, Bart, the thing is that when you asked them, they didn't say, no, we wouldn't do that. I mean, they said maybe. And they, in fact, even offered some justifications as to why. So Jason, respond to that.
I agree with the last part. Absolutely. It's Bart's reporting is remarkable and incredibly important to get people on the record saying this is not a hollow exercise that people are doing now as we speak. Over 30 million votes have already been cast, you know, and when people go to the polls en masse on November 3rd, that is going to mean something. That is not an advisory vote. And that is not to be just overturned by the legislature because they throw up their hands and say, you know, the mail's too busy. That's an incredible point that Bart is making in his reporting is deep and necessary. But the first part is I think where we do disagree a little bit, which is the proposition that nothing sort of stops the legislature from just saying we can. It's too going to take us too long to count. We don't have an accurate count. I think there are a couple of things that stop the legislature there. You know, one is. It actually, the counts will be completed. I mean, the longest it took in the course of this pandemic for states to count votes and have really a final result of 99% of votes is about 9 days. And that only happened in a few states. That's in the 2020 primaries. I hope more states have their stuff together, but that's, you know, to get that result is we have 5 weeks under the current deadline. So 9 days is more than enough. And I think courts can stop it. There are due process rights that voters have to have their votes not only cast but counted. The courts have made that clear. I'm not saying that there won't be creative arguments and that the Supreme Court is not potentially inclined to put a thumb on the scale for Trump if it's close, but I think it will be very difficult to go into court and say, the board of canvassers said that Biden won Michigan by 200,000 votes, but the legislature said that was riven with fraud and it doesn't violate due process to just undo that. I think that's a tough argument. Not impossible, but tough.
So let's take this back down to the state level where these counts are actually going to be happening just for a moment. Because, for example, Arizona, a swing state actually this year, and they are beginning counting ballots already as of now. And just yesterday, we talked to Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs about what's happening in Arizona.
Voting is complicated. Democracy is hard, and voters need information. And so we've put a lot of resources into that, particularly in disenfranchised communities. And I think the pandemic really highlighted a lot of the inequities that exist, not just in voting, but in everything. And so I think that those resources are more important now than ever to make sure that voters have the information that they need to be informed.
Now, Katie Hobbs, the Secretary of State of Arizona, is a Democrat. Republicans have the majority in the state legislature there, and Arizona's governor is also a Republican. Hobbs tells us she's in weekly meetings with other secretaries of state around the country to discuss best practices and issues they're running into regarding election security and information.
It is incumbent upon every election official in the country to be as neutral and nonpartisan as possible. That helps to ensure the public's confidence in the system and in our offices that we're doing our job and not trying to put our thumb on the scale. I think that's so critical. And I've made it a point to not endorse candidates or ballot measures, anything like that, because I think that just the perception there is bad, even though it's perfectly legal to do those things. It's so critical, especially now when secretaries of state and election officials and our elections themselves are under so much scrutiny, to do everything we can to counter that and make sure the public knows that we really are working to administer elections that are fair and secure and accurate.
So that's Katie Hobbs, the Secretary of State for Arizona. Barton and Jason, hang on here for a second, because I want to bring in one more voice. Why not? We'll have a big diversity of legal opinion today. Bertrall Ross joins us. He's Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California and a member of the Ad Hoc Committee for the 2020 Election Fairness and Legitimacy. Professor Ross, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Megan.
Okay,
good to see you.
So you've been on a couple of times before talking to us about election integrity issues, and you've heard Bart and Jason discuss in detail the things to be cognizant of and calm about regarding what happens after November 3rd. Do you feel that the sense of calm and confidence that Jason says we should be?
I do not. I want to feel a sense of calm and confidence, but I do not. I still have a bit of worry. I agree with Jason that it's important not to be too alarmist, but it's also important not to be complacent. We don't want to talk ourselves into a constitutional crisis involving this election, but we also don't want to be entirely unprepared. And I guess my worry is that Jason noted that, you know, good faith in the system would have to break down everywhere. And I don't think it has to break down everywhere. I just think it needs to break down somewhere. And to provide a basis for a claim that there's something amiss with this particular election. And we have a Republican candidate, Donald Trump, who's been notorious about breaking norms, and a party that has been unusually loyal to him from the federal level down to the state and down to the local level. And we live in an environment in which we just have a very difficult time agreeing upon any set of facts and little trust in the system. And so given that context, it's ripe for some sort of crisis that could occur. But I agree completely with Jason in the sense that, and I think Barton agrees, that it has to be a very close election for this crisis to arise. And the scenario is much more likely in which Biden wins by a clear victory or Trump wins the election. In either scenario, I don't think you have this issue of a crisis. But I do worry that it doesn't have to be close as 2000 for a crisis to occur. And given that these absentee ballots are coming in at unprecedented levels, states are pretty unprepared for the absentee ballot count, it could lead to a situation in which there's no determination of the victor for several days after the election, and it gives opportunity to sow more distrust in the system that could contribute to a crisis that occurs afterwards.
Yeah. So Bart, let me turn back to you, because to Professor Ross's point, maybe it doesn't have to be as close as Florida was. I think it just has to be close in certain places. And you, in fact, in your piece, you write through a scenario where, say, Pennsylvania does end up sending multiple slates of electors and it gets kicked up to Congress. And the idea that we would expect in 2020 Congress to act in a good faith manner, in a nonpartisan manner, it's beyond the pale, I think, and that's the second constitutional crisis that you write about theoretically in your piece.
I don't think it has to be terribly close for Trump to do his best to throw smoke and try to prevent the system from reaching a verdict against him. And let's not forget that he is the chief law enforcement officer of the federal government and commands a very large bureaucracy and is capable of creating additional authorities to murk up the picture. Suppose that the Attorney General sends U.S. Marshals to seize ballots, declares that there is an ongoing serious investigation of major fraud in the count, and preservation of evidence is required. And although the federal government ordinarily is not does not have jurisdiction over elections, which are state affairs, there are federal fraud statutes at issue, and he has superseding authority in these circumstances and so forth. Again, this might be an exercise that would be ultimately laughed out of court, might or might not. But the point is, what chaos can be sown in the short term? And to Jason's previous point, let's say that the Pennsylvania legislature appoints Republican electors, notwithstanding the certified official vote. Only after the fact can courts get involved. And then a court, a Pennsylvania court, and it worked its way up through to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, says, no, you can't do that. You're changing the rules after the election. It's already been sent to Congress. Congress now says, we don't accept Pennsylvania court's jurisdiction over the federal constitutional question under Article 2. And so it doesn't matter at that point politically whether the Pennsylvania court has said it's okay or not, because Congress now has jurisdiction over the question.
So we've just got 2 minutes left here. And Jason and Bertrand, I'm going to leave the last 2 minutes for you, because you know, the thinking through these various scenarios is something that I think it's safe to say most Americans never have done, never even have thought to do. I mean, who out there, I'll raise my hand, I didn't really think about the period of safe harbor before at all until reading Bart's piece. So come November 3rd, and Jason, I'll just start with you quickly. I'll give both of you about 30 seconds here. What are the things that you're going to be looking for in terms of flags that might be raised for you to actually start thinking like, okay, maybe we should be worried about some of these potential scenarios coming to pass? What are you going to be looking for?
The first thing for me to look for will be what Fox News is saying, candidly, because the media is an important part of this. I think Bart has talked about this in his article too, and it's important to remember that the message has to get disseminated somehow. And so there was a famous moment a couple of elections ago where Karl Rove refused to believe that Obama had been reelected, and the anchors walked him over to the decision desk and they said, "No, Mr. Rove, he won. Here's the numbers." If that happens again, Mega, I think we're in good shape. If not, it could be tough.
Okay, Bertrand, you got about 20 seconds. What are you going to be looking for?
I'm looking to see whether Pennsylvania and Wisconsin or Michigan will turn into the pivotal states, and seeing how they're processing ballots. And if it's going slowly and under disputes, I'm seeing problems ahead.
Okay, so look for how ballots are being processed in key states. Look to see how Fox News is talking about it. Bertrand Ross, Jason Harrow, and Barton Gellman, thank you so much to the three of you for joining us today. And by the way, Bart's piece is called "The Election That Could Break America." It appeared in The Atlantic. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Definitely worth your time. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.